I'm going to talk about some of the themes that I strike in this book, although not all of them. One of the longest chapters in the book is actually on the porn industry. We're a pornified culture. It is probably one of the most disturbing examples of how human beings, and in particular women in this culture, are commodified, turned into objects. But the thrust of the book is celebrity and commodity culture and what it has done to us. In celebrity culture, we destroy what we worship. The commercial exploitation of Michael Jackson's death was orchestrated by the corporate forces that render Jackson insane. Jackson, robbed of his childhood and surrounded by vultures that preyed on his fears and weaknesses, was so consumed by self-loathing, he carved his African-American face into a Caucasian death mask. He hid his apparent pedophilia behind a Peter Pan illusion of eternal childhood. He could not disengage his public and his private self. He became a commodity, a product, one to be sold, used, and manipulated. He was infected by the moral nihilism and personal disintegration that is at the core of our corporate culture. And his fantasies of eternal youth, delusions of majesty, and desperate, disfiguring quests for physical transformation were an expression of our own yearning. He was a reflection of us in the extreme. His memorial service, a variety show with a coffin, had an average of 31.1 million television viewers. It was the final episode of the long-running Michael Jackson series. And the stories that enthrall us most are real-life stories, early fame, wild success, and then a long, bizarre, and macabre emotional train wreck. O.J. Simpson offered a tamer version of the same plot. So does Britney Spears. Jackson, by the end, was heavily in debt and had weathered a $22 million out-of-court settlement to Jordy Chandler, as well as 7 counts of child sexual abuse and 2 counts of administering an intoxicating agent in order to commit a felony. Jackson reflected back to us our own physical and psychological disintegration, especially with many Americans struggling with overwhelming debt, loss of status, and deep personal confusion. The lurid drama of Jackson's personal life meshed with the ongoing dramas on television, in movies, and the news. News reports on television are mini-dramas. They provide a star, a villain, a supporting cast, a good-looking host, and a dramatic, if often unexpected, ending. In Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury's novel about a future dystopia, people spend most of the day watching giant television screens that show endless scenes of police chases and criminal apprehensions. Life, Bradbury understood, once it was packaged, scripted, given a narrative, and filmed, became the most compelling form of entertainment. And Jackson was a great show. He deserved a great finale. Those who created Jackson's public persona and turned him into a piece of property, first as a child and finally as a corpse encased in a $15,000 golden casket, are the agents, publicists, marketing departments, promoters, scriptwriters, television and movie producers, advertisers, video technicians, photographers, bodyguards, recording executives, wardrobe consultants, fitness trainers, pollsters, public announcers, and television news personalities who orchestrate the vast stage of celebrity for profit. They are the puppet masters. No one achieves celebrity status. No cultural illusion is swallowed as reality without these armies of cultural enablers and intermediaries. The producers at the Staples Centers in Los Angeles made sure the 18,000 attendees and television audience, and even the BBC, devoted 3 hours to the tribute. Watched a funeral that was turned into another maudlin form of uplifting popular entertainment. The memorial service for Jackson was a celebration of celebrity. There was the queasy sight of groups of children, including his own, singing over the coffin. Brooke Shields, fighting back tears, recalled how she and a 33-year-old Jackson, who always maintained that he was a straight male, broke into Elizabeth Taylor's room the night before her wedding because Michael was too excited to wait until morning to see the wedding gown. Shields and Jackson at Taylor's wedding then, quote, pretended to be the mother and father of Elizabeth Taylor. It sounds weird, Shields said, but we made it real. There were photo montages in which a shot of Michael Jackson shaking hands with Nelson Mandela was immediately followed by one of him with Kermit the Frog. Celebrity culture reduces all of the famous to the same level. Fame is its own denominator, and every anecdote told about Jackson seemed to confirm that when you spend your life as a celebrity, you have no idea who you are. And yet, we measure our lives by these celebrities. We seek to be like them. We emulate their look and behavior. We escape the messiness of real life through the fantasy of their stardom. We too long to attract admiring audiences for our grand, ongoing life movie. We try to see ourselves moving through our life as a camera would see us, mindful of how we hold ourselves, how we dress, what we say. We invent movies that play inside our heads with us as stars. We wonder how an audience would react. Celebrity culture has taught us almost unconsciously to generate interior personal screenplays. We have learned ways of speaking and thinking that grossly disfigure the way we relate to the world and those around us. Neil Gabler, who has written wisely about this, argues that celebrity culture is not a convergence of consumer culture and religion, so much as a hostile takeover of religion by consumer culture. Jackson desperately feared growing old. He believed he could manipulate race and gender. He transformed himself through surgery and perhaps female hormones from a brown-skinned African-American male to a chalk-faced androgynous figure with no clear sexual identity. And while he pushed these boundaries to the extreme, he only did what many Americans do. There were 12 million cosmetic plastic surgery procedures performed last year in the United States. They were performed because in America, most human beings, rich and poor, famous and obscure, have been conditioned to view themselves as marketable commodities. They are objects like consumer products. They have no intrinsic value. They must look fabulous and live on fabulous sets. They must remain young. They must achieve notoriety and money, or the illusion of it, to be a success. And it does not matter how they get there. Celebrity culture licenses a dark voyeurism into other people's humiliation, pain, weakness, and betrayal. Education, building community, honesty, transparency, and sharing are qualities that will see you ridiculed and voted off any reality show. Fellow competitors for prize money and a chance for fleeting fame elect to disappear the unwanted. In the final credits of the reality show, America's Next Top Model, A picture of the woman expelled during the episode vanishes from the group portrait on the screen. Those cast aside become, at least to the television audience, non-persons. Celebrities that can no longer generate publicity, good or bad, vanish. Life, these shows teach, is a brutal world of unadulterated competition and a constant quest for notoriety and attention. And our self-exaltation permits us to humiliate those who oppose us. Those who win are the best. Those who lose deserve to be erased. Those who fail, those who are deemed to be weak or poor or ugly, are belittled and mocked. Human beings are used, betrayed, and discarded in a commodity culture, which is pretty much the story of Jackson's life. The cult of self, which Jackson embodied, dominates our culture. This cult has within it the classic traits of psychopaths: superficial charm, grandiosity and self-importance, a need for constant stimulation, a penchant for lying, deception, and manipulation, and the incapacity for remorse or guilt. Jackson, from his phony marriages to the portraits of himself dressed as royalty, to his insatiable hunger for new toys, to his questionable relationships with young boys, had all these qualities. And this is also the ethic promoted by corporations. It is the ethic of unfettered capitalism. It is the misguided belief that personal style and personal advancement, mistaken for individualism, are the same as democratic equality. It is the celebration of image over substance. We have a right in the cult of the self to get whatever we desire. We can do anything, even belittle and destroy those around us, including our friends, to make money, to be happy, and to become famous. Once fame and wealth are achieved, they become their own justification, their own morality. How one gets there is irrelevant. And it was this perverted ethic that gave us Wall Street bankers and investment houses that willfully trashed the global economy, stole money from tens of millions of small shareholders who had bought stock in these corporations for retirement or college. The heads of these corporations, like the winners on a reality television program who lied and manipulated others to succeed, walked away with hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses and compensation. The ethic of Wall Street is the ethic of celebrity. But the tantalizing illusions offered by our consumer culture are vanishing as we barrel towards collapse. The ability of the corporate state to pacify the country by extending credit and providing cheap manufactured goods to the masses is gone. The jobs we are shedding are not coming back, as Lawrence Summers tacitly acknowledges when he talks of a jobless recovery. The belief that democracy lies in the choice between competing brands and the freedom to accumulate vast sums of personal wealth at the expense of others has been exposed as a fraud. Freedom can no longer be conflated with the free market. The travails of the poor are rapidly becoming the travails of the middle class, especially as unemployment insurance runs out. And class warfare, once buried under the happy illusion that we were all going to enter an age of prosperity with unfettered capitalism, is returning. How will we cope with our decline? Will we cling to the absurd dreams of an imperial power and the fantasies of a glorious tomorrow? Or will we responsibly face our stark new limitations? Will we heed those who are sober and rational, those who speak of a new simplicity and humility in an age of imperial as well as material decline? Or will we follow the demagogues and charlatans who rise up in moments of crisis to offer fantastic visions of new glory? Will we radically transform our system to one that protects the ordinary citizen and fosters the common good, that defies the corporate state, that dismantles empire? Or will we employ the brutality and technology of our internal security and surveillance apparatus to crush dissent and drive us into a new dark age? In his book, Democracy Incorporated, Sheldon Wolin, who taught political philosophy at Berkeley and later at Princeton, uses the phrase inverted totalitarianism to describe our political system. Inverted totalitarianism, unlike classical totalitarianism, does not revolve around a demagogue or charismatic leader. It finds its expression in the anonymity of the corporate state. It purports to cherish democracy, patriotism, and the Constitution, while manipulating internal levers to subvert and thwart the democratic process. Political candidates are elected in popular votes by citizens, but are beholden to armies of corporate lobbyists in Washington or state capitals, who author the legislation and get the legislators to pass it. A corporate media controls nearly everything we read, watch, or hear. It imposes a bland uniformity of opinion. It diverts us with trivia and celebrity gossip. In classical totalitarian regimes, such as Nazi fascism or Soviet communism, economics was subordinate to politics. Under inverted totalitarianism, the reverse is true, Wolin writes. Economics dominates politics, and with that domination comes different forms of ruthlessness. The Obama brand offers us an image that appears radically individualistic and new. This image inoculates us from seeing that the old engines of corporate power and the vast military-industrial complex continue to plunder the country. Brand Obama is about being happy consumers. We are entertained, we feel hopeful, we like our president, we believe he is like us. But like all branded products spun out from the manipulative world of corporate advertising, we are being duped into doing and supporting a lot of things that are not in our interest. What for all our faith and hope has the Obama brand given us? His administration has spent, lent, or guaranteed $12.8 trillion in taxpayer dollars to Wall Street and insolvent banks in a doomed effort to reinflate the bubble economy. A tactic that at best forestalls catastrophe and will leave us broke in a time of profound crisis. Brand Obama has allocated nearly $1 trillion in defense-related spending and the continuation of our doomed imperial project in Iraq, where military planners now estimate that 70,000 troops will remain for the next 15 to 20 years. Brand Obama has expanded the war in Afghanistan, including the use of drones sent on cross-border bombing runs into Pakistan that have left some 700 civilians dead since Obama took office. Brand Obama has refused to ease restrictions so workers can organize, and because of pressure from the for-profit healthcare industry, refuses to consider single-payer, not-for-profit healthcare for all Americans. And Brand Obama will not prosecute the Bush administration for war crimes, including the use of torture, and has refused to dismantle Bush's secrecy laws or restore habeas corpus. Corporations, which control our politics, no longer produce products that are different, but brands that are different. Brand Obama does not threaten the core of the corporate state any more than did Brand George W. Bush. The Bush brand collapsed. We became immune to its studied folksiness. We saw through its artifice, and this is a common deflation in the world of advertising. So we have been given a new Obama brand with an exciting and faintly erotic appeal. Benetton and Calvin Klein were the precursors to the Obama brand, using ads to associate themselves with risque style and progressive politics. It gave their products an edge. But the goal, as with all brands, was to fool passive consumers that a brand is an experience. The decline of American empire began long before the current economic meltdown or the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It began before the first Gulf War or Ronald Reagan. It began when we shifted, in the words of the Harvard historian Charles Mayer, from an empire of production to an empire of consumption. By the end of the Vietnam War, when the costs of the war ate away at Lyndon Johnson's great society, and domestic oil production began its steady, inexorable decline, we saw our country transform from one that primarily produced to one that primarily consumed. We started borrowing to maintain a lifestyle as well as an empire we could no longer afford. We began to use force, especially in the Middle East, to feed our insatiable thirst for cheap oil. And the bill is now due. America's most dangerous enemies are not Islamic radicals, but those who sold us the perverted ideology of free market capitalism and globalization. They have dynamited the foundations of our society. In the 17th century, these speculators would have been hung. Today, they run the government and consume billions in taxpayer subsidies. These corporate forces will never permit real reform. It would mean their extinction. The oil and gas industry will never allow us to achieve energy independence. That would devastate their profits. Real reform would wipe out tens of billions of dollars in weapons contracts. It would cripple the financial health of a host of private contractors, from Lockheed Martin to Boeing to Northrop Grumman to Raytheon to Halliburton. And it would render obsolete the existence of the U.S. Central Command. It was Bill Clinton who led the Democratic Party to the corporate watering trough. Clinton argued that the party could ditch labor unions, no longer a source of votes or power, as a political ally. Workers, he insisted, would vote Democratic anyway. They had no choice. It was better, he argued, to take corporate money and do corporate bidding. By the 1990s, the Democratic Party, under Clinton's leadership, had virtual fundraising parity with the Republicans. Today, the Democrats get more. The legislation demanded by corporations, including the North American Free Trade Agreement, thrust a knife into the back of the American working class. NAFTA was peddled by the Clinton White House as an opportunity to raise the incomes and prosperity of the citizens of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. NAFTA would also, we were told, staunch Mexican immigration into the United States. But NAFTA, which took effect in 1994, had the effect of reversing every one of Clinton's rosy predictions. Once the Mexican government lifted price supports on corn and beans grown by Mexican farmers, those farmers had to compete against the huge agribusinesses in the United States. Many Mexican farmers were swiftly bankrupt. At least 2 million Mexican farmers have been driven off their land since 1994. And guess where many of them went? This desperate flight of poor Mexicans into the United States is now being exacerbated by large-scale factory closures along the border as manufacturers pack up and leave Mexico for the cut-rate embrace of China's totalitarian capitalism. But we were assured that goods would be cheaper, workers would be wealthier, everyone would be happier. I'm not sure how these contradictory things were supposed to happen, but in a soundbite society, reality no longer matters. NAFTA was great if you were a corporation. It was a disaster if you were a worker. And we are now getting a taste of Clinton's draconian welfare reform bill signed in 1996 as tens of millions of people begin to lose their unemployment benefits and attempt to survive on $143 a month from welfare. It was the Clinton administration, led by Summers, which signed into law the Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999. The act ripped down the firewalls that had been established by the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, designed to prevent the kind of meltdown we are now experiencing. Glass-Steagall established the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It set in place banking reforms to stop speculators from hijacking the financial system. With Glass-Steagall demolished and the passage of NAFTA, the Democrats, led by Clinton, tumbled gleefully into bed with corporations and Wall Street speculators. And many of the architects of this deregulation, economists such as Summers, have come back again to service these corporations in the Obama White House. The cost of our empire of illusion is not being paid for by corporate titans. It is being paid for on the streets of our inner cities, in former manufacturing towns, and in depressed rural enclaves. Human beings are not commodities. They are not goods. Their misery is not the regrettable price of globalization and the free market. They grieve and suffer and feel despair. They raise children and struggle to maintain communities. The growing class divide is not understood, despite the glibness of many in the media, by complicated sets of statistics, lines on a graph that charts stocks, or the absurd utopian faith in unregulated globalization and complicated trade deals. It is understood in the eyes of a man or woman who is no longer making enough money to live with dignity and hope. The growing desperation across the United States is unleashing not simply a recession. We have been in a recession for some time now, but a depression, unlike anything we have seen since the 1930s. It has provided a pool of broken people willing to work for low wages and to do without unions and benefits. For the bottom 90% of Americans' annual income has been on a slow, steady decline for three decades. There are 50 million Americans in real poverty and tens of millions of Americans in a category called near poverty. And our elites manipulate statistics and data to foster illusions of growth and prosperity to mask the damage. They refuse to admit, at least to us, that they have lost control, since to lose control is to concede failure. They contribute instead to the collective denial of reality by insisting that another multi-billion dollar bailout or government loan will prop up the shattered edifice. And the well-paid television pundits and news celebrities, the economists and the banking and financial sector leaders, see the world from inside the comfort of the corporate box and are loyal to the corporate state. The assault on the American working class, an assault that has devastated members of my own family in former mill towns in Maine, shows no sign of abatement. In the past 3 years, nearly one in five U.S. workers was laid off. Among workers laid off from full-time work, roughly one-fourth were earning less than $40,000 a year. There are whole sections of the United States that now resemble the developing world. There has been a Weimarization of the American working class, and the assault on the middle class is underway. Anything that can be put on software, from finance to architecture to engineering, can and is being outsourced to workers in countries such as India or China, who accept pay a fraction of that of their Western counterparts and work without benefits. And both the Republican and Democratic parties, beholden to corporations for money and power, are responsible. Washington has become our Versailles. The media has evolved into a class of courtiers. The Democrats, like the Republicans, are mostly courtiers. Our pundits, academics, and economists, at least those with prominent public platforms, are courtiers. We are captivated by the hollow stagecraft of political theater as we are ruthlessly stripped of power. The role of courtiers is to parrot official propaganda. Courtiers do not defy the elite or question the structure of the corporate state. The corporations, in return, employ them and promote them as celebrities or elected officials. Courtiers in face powder deceive us in the name of journalism. Courtiers in our political parties promise to look out for our interests and then pass bill after bill to further corporate fraud and abuse. But no class of courtiers, from the eunuchs behind the Manchus in the 19th century to the Baghdad caliphs in the Abbasid caliphate, has ever transformed itself into a responsible and socially productive class. Courtiers are hedonists of power. And being a courtier requires agility and eloquence. The most talented of them should be credited as persuasive actors. They entertain us, they make us feel good, they persuade us, they are our friends. They are the smiley faces of a corporate state that has hijacked the government. And when the corporations make their iron demands, these courtiers drop to their knees. They placate the telecommunications companies that want to be protected from lawsuits. They permit oil and gas companies to rake in obscene profits and keep in place the vast subsidies of corporate welfare doled out by the state. They allow our profit-driven healthcare system to leave the uninsured and underinsured to suffer and die. And over 20,000 Americans died last year because they could not get proper medical care. The healthcare industry, like the defense industry, profits from death. It is legally permitted to hold sick children hostage while their families frantically bankrupt themselves to save their sons or daughters. Any discussion of health care should acknowledge the fact that our for-profit health care system is the problem and must be destroyed. Only then can we have an honest debate about what comes next. But this will never happen. It will never happen because the industry's money and lobbyists drive the discussion, and the courtiers in Washington and on the television screens dance to the tune they play. America is devolving into a third world nation. And if we do not immediately halt our elite's rapacious looting of the public treasury and our bizarre state socialism for corporations, we will be left with trillions in debts which can never be repaid, and widespread human misery which we will be helpless to ameliorate. Our anemic democracy will be replaced with a robust national police state. The elite will withdraw into heavily guarded, gated communities where they will have access to security, goods, and services that cannot be afforded by the rest of us. Tens of millions of people, brutally controlled, will live in perpetual poverty, a state of neo-feudalism. This is the inevitable result of unchecked corporate capitalism. And the stimulus and bailout plans are not about saving us. They are about saving them. As the economist Paul Krugman has noted, anyone who has seen how economic statistics are constructed knows that they are really a subgenre of science fiction. This science fiction has been steadily employed to camouflage our economic decline. President Reagan included 1.5 million U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine service personnel with a civilian workforce to magically reduce the nation's unemployment rate by 2%. President Clinton decided that those who had given up looking for work, or those who wanted full-time jobs but could only find part-time employment, were no longer to be counted as unemployed. His trick disappeared some 5 million unemployed from the official unemployment rolls. If you work more than 21 hours a week, and most low-wage workers at places like Walmart average 28 hours a week, you are counted as employed, although your real wages put you below the poverty line. Our actual unemployment rate, when you include those who have stopped looking for work and those who can only find poorly paid part-time jobs, is not 9%, but somewhere between 17 and 20%. A sixth of the country is now effectively unemployed. And we are shedding jobs at a faster rate than in the months after the 1929 crash. Franklin Delano Roosevelt recognized the danger of unregulated capitalism. He sent a message to Congress on April 29, 1938, titled, "Recommendations to the Congress to Curb Monopolies and the Concentration of Economic Power." In it, he wrote, "The first truth is that the liberty of democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of power to a point where it becomes stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism, ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling private power. The second truth is that the liberty of democracy is not safe if its business system does not provide employment and produce and distribute goods in such a way to sustain an acceptable standard of living. The rise of the corporate state has grave political consequences, as we saw in Italy and Germany in the early part of the 20th century. Antitrust laws not only regulate and control the marketplace, they serve as bulwarks to protect democracy. And now that they are gone, now that we have a state run by and on behalf of corporations, we must expect inevitable and, I fear, terrifying consequences. As the pressure mounts, as this despair and desperation reaches into larger and larger segments of the populace, the mechanisms of corporate and government control are being bolstered to prevent civil unrest and instability. The emergence of the corporate state always means the emergence of the security state. And this is why the Bush White House pushed through the Patriot Act and its renewal, the suspension of habeas corpus, the practice of extraordinary rendition, warrantless wiretapping on American citizens, and the refusal to ensure free and fair elections with verifiable ballot counting. The motive behind these measures is not to fight terrorism or to bolster national security. It is to seize and maintain internal control, and it is about control of us. Senator Frank Church, as chairman of the Select Committee on Intelligence in 1975, investigated the government's massive and highly secretive National Security Agency. He was alarmed at the ability of the state to intrude into private lives. He wrote, when he finished his investigation, "That capacity, that capability at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left. Such is the capability to monitor everything. Telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide. If this government ever became a tyranny, if a dictator ever took charge in this country, the technological capacity that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose total tyranny. And there would be no way to fight back, because the most careful effort to combine together in resistance to the government, no matter how privately it was done, is within the reach of the government to know." When Senator Church made this statement, the National Security Agency was not authorized to spy on American citizens. Today it is. In his book, The Great Transformation, written in 1944, Carl Pugliani laid out the devastating consequences, the depressions, wars, and totalitarianism that grow out of a so-called self-regulated free market. He grasped that fascism, like socialism, was rooted in a market society that refused to function. He warned that a financial system always devolved without heavy government control into a mafia capitalism and a mafia political system. All traditional standards and beliefs are shattered in a severe economic crisis. The moral order is turned upside down. The honest and industrious are wiped out, while the gangsters, profiteers, and speculators walk away with millions. A self-regulating market inevitably turns human beings and the natural environment into commodities, a situation that ensures the destruction of both society and the natural world. The free market's assumption that nature and human beings are objects whose worth is determined by the market allows each to be exploited for profit until exhaustion or collapse. A society that no longer recognizes that nature and human life have a sacred dimension, an intrinsic value beyond monetary value, commits collective suicide. Such societies cannibalize themselves until they die. And we face an environmental meltdown that is linked to our economic meltdown. Polar ice caps are melting. Sea levels are rising. The planet is warming at an alarming rate. Droughts are destroying croplands. Russia's northern coastline has begun producing huge quantities of toxic methane gas. Scientists with the International Siberian Shelf Study described what they saw along the coastline recently as methane chimneys reaching from the sea floor to the ocean's surface. Methane locked in the permafrost of Arctic landmasses is being released at an alarming rate as average Arctic temperatures rise. Methane is a greenhouse gas 25 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. The release of millions of tons of it will significantly accelerate the rate of global warming. The continued release of large quantities of methane, some scientists have warned, could actually asphyxiate the human species. But even in the face of this crisis, the oil and natural gas industry, along with the coal industry, have blunted serious reform. Profit comes before the urgent task to save the ecosystem on which human life depends. Our working class, which has desperately borrowed money to stay afloat as real wages have dropped, now face years, maybe decades, of stagnant or declining incomes without access to new credit. The national treasury is being drained on behalf of speculative commercial interests. The government, the only institution citizens have that is big enough and powerful enough to protect its rights, is becoming weaker, more anemic, and increasingly unable to help the mass of Americans who are embarking on a period of profound deprivation. We have been borrowing at the rate of more than $2 billion a day over the last 10 years. And at some point, it has to stop. The moment China and the oil-rich states and other international investors stop buying treasury bonds and walk away from the dollar, which now appears to be underway, our currency will become junk. Inflation will rocket upwards and we will become Weimar Germany, a furious and sustained backlash by a betrayed and angry populace, one unprepared emotionally, intellectually, and psychologically for collapse. We'll sweep aside the Democrats and most of the Republicans. It was the economic collapse in Yugoslavia that gave us Slobodan Milosevic. It was the Weimar Republic that vomited up Adolf Hitler. And it was the breakdown in Tsarist Russia that opened the door for Lenin and the Bolsheviks. A cobble of proto-fascist misfits, from Christian demagogues to loudmouth talk show hosts, who we naively dismiss as buffoons, will find a following with promises of revenge and moral renewal. There are powerful corporate entities fearful of losing their influence and wealth arrayed against us. These anti-democratic forces, which will seek to make an alliance with the radical Christian right and other extremists, will use fear, chaos, the hatred for the ruling elites, and the specter of left-wing dissent and terrorism to impose draconian controls to extinguish our democracy. And while they do it, they will be waving the American flag, chanting patriotic slogans, promising law and order, and clutching the Christian cross. Totalitarianism, George Orwell pointed out, is not so much an age of faith, but an age of schizophrenia. A society becomes totalitarian when its structure becomes flagrantly artificial, Orwell wrote. That is, when its ruling class has lost its function, but succeeds to clinging to power by force or fraud. And force is soon all our elites will have left. Mass culture assures us, even in the midst of catastrophe, that if we close our eyes, if we visualize what we want, if we have faith in ourselves, if we tell God that we believe in miracles, if we tap into our inner strength, if we grasp that we are truly exceptional, if we focus on happiness, our lives will be harmonious and complete. This cultural retreat into illusion, whether peddled by positive psychologists, Hollywood, or Christian preachers, is a form of magical thinking. It turns worthless mortgages and debt into wealth. It turns the destruction of our manufacturing base into an opportunity for growth. It turns alienation and anxiety into cheerful conformity. It turns a nation that wages illegal wars and administers offshore penal colonies where it openly practices torture into the greatest democracy on earth. It is time to fight back against corporate culture in small and large ways. Coalitions of environmental, anti-nuclear, anti-capitalist, sustainable agriculture, and anti-globalization forces have coalesced in Europe to form and support socialist parties. This has yet to happen in the United States. The left never rallied in significant numbers behind Cynthia McKinney or Ralph Nader, and this was our mistake. In picking the lesser of two evils, it threw its lot in with a Democratic Party that again has proven that it backs our imperial wars, empowers the national security state, does the bidding of corporations, and ignores the needs of citizens. If Obama does not end the flagrant theft of taxpayer funds by corporations and the disgraceful abandonment of our working class, especially as foreclosures and unemployment mount, many in the country will turn in desperation to the far right embodied by groups such as Christian radicals. The failure by progressives to offer a democratic socialist alternative, the only alternative remaining that can save our open society, to openly make war on corporate power, the decision to continue to back the Democratic Party, will mean that there will be in the eyes of many embittered and struggling working and middle class Americans no alternative but a perverted Christian fascism. I spent 2 years traveling the country to write a book on the Christian right called American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War on America. I visited former manufacturing towns where for many, the end of the world is no longer an abstraction. They have lost hope. Fear and instability has plunged the working class into profound personal and economic despair, and not surprisingly, into the arms of demagogues and charlatans of the radical Christian right, who offer a belief in magic, miracles, and the fiction of a utopian Christian nation. And unless we rapidly re-enfranchise these dispossessed workers into the economy, unless we give them hope, our democracy is doomed. Democracies, as writers as ancient as Plutarch and Thucydides grasped, cannot be sustained in oligarchic states. We forgot that social reform never comes from accommodating the power structure, but frightening it. The Liberty Party, which fought slavery, the suffragists who battled for women's rights, the labor movement and the civil rights movement knew that the question was not how do we get good people to rule. Most of those attracted to power are at best mediocrities and often venal. But how do we limit the damage the powerful do to us? These mass movements were the real engines for social reform, the correctives to our democracy, and the true protectors of the rights of citizens. We must begin to opt out of the mainstream. We must rebuild socialism as a viable political force. We must no longer be content with the crumbs tossed to us in the vain hope that we can influence the power elite from the inside. We must become as militant as those seeking our enslavement. If we remain passive, we will soon be engulfed by a ruthless totalitarian capitalism. If we remain passive as we undergo the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history, we will become serfs. If we fight back, we have a chance. The saturation coverage of Jackson's death was one of many examples of our collective flight into illusion. It deflected the moral questions arising from mounting social injustice, growing inequalities, failing imperial wars, economic collapse, and political corruption. As we sink into an economic and political morass, as we barrel towards a crisis that will create more misery than the Great Depression, we remain controlled, manipulated, and distracted by the celluloid shadows on the wall of Plato's cave. The fantasy of celebrity culture is not designed simply to entertain. It is designed to drain us emotionally, confuse us about our identity, blame ourselves for our predicament, condition us to chase illusions of impossible fame and happiness and keep us from fighting back. And in the end, that is all the Jackson coverage was really about. Another tawdry and tasteless spectacle to divert a dying culture from the baying wolf at the gate. Thank you. The further we opt out of the mainstream, the more we hurt the corporation. 70% of the U.S. economy depends on consumption, which is why the economic advisors in the White House and Geithner and are desperately trying to convince Americans that the recession is over so that they will spend. Don't buy anything new, except my book. The more you shop at a consignment store, the more you refuse to fuel the commodity culture, the more you have the capacity to hurt their profits. Forget the Democratic Party. It's over. I didn't vote for Obama. I voted for Nader. And I supported Kucinich in the primaries and then voted for Nader. Because the simple economic fact is that we cannot afford our empire. And if you read the twilight hours of the Roman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the British Empire, you find a similar kind of flight into illusion. Cicero wrote about it. Joseph Roth wrote about it. We can't afford it. That's just the simple fact. And what's happening is that we are borrowing at massive rates while we are literally hollowing the country out from the inside in terms of our infrastructure, sewage treatment, jobs, public schools. And either we begin to responsibly face a different world or we continue to live in illusion. Dreams are something you strive towards. Illusions are something you live in. And as that chasm opens up between the illusion of who we think we are and what is possible, and the reality of the job not coming back and the house being foreclosed, the longer you remain in that state of illusion, the longer you remain in a state of kind of perpetual childishness, infantilism, because you are responding through a belief system that is non-reality based. We are not going to borrow our way back to the bubble economy. China will not endlessly fund our imperial expansion, 761 military bases around the world. And I don't think that the decline of imperial power or the decline of the consumer economy means a debasement of our lifestyle. In fact, I think it has the capacity to get us back in touch with a new kind of humility and a new kind of simplicity, which enriches life. Consumer societies are very skillful at manipulating and oftentimes creating anxieties. And the false belief that the consumption will somehow alleviate these anxieties. So out of the mainstream, to the extent that we can unplug ourselves from the consumer culture as much as possible, and I think really not being spun anymore by the Democratic Party. Well, this is, if you look at what happened in Bangkok, it's terrifying. Of course, the Bush administration refused to sign Kyoto. Carbon emissions from the signing of Kyoto until now in the United States have increased by 20%. They increased by 2% in Europe. Now European countries want to scrap Kyoto. They want to unilaterally impose their own emission standards and then have it self-regulated. Most, of course, of emissions are produced by industrialized countries. The new treaty, at least if we go by what's happening in Bangkok, will no longer put the onus of responsibility on industrialized countries, but treat all countries the same. It's a gigantic step backwards. And I love Bill McKibben and admire him greatly, and everything that he calls for us to do is correct. However, if we don't break the back of the corporate state, as Polanyi understood in his great work. It is a kind of cannibalization. They will destroy the ecosystem for profit. And I don't think there's any question about that.
I believe the common wisdom is that the economic collapse that we're facing is done by misstep on the part of economists and missteps on the part of the Treasury. But I actually believe that this has been in the planning for a long time, that Barack Obama, and much like George Bush and Clinton before him, have been puppets of the New World Order and are intentionally trying to collapse the republic that was the United States. And one of the ways to collapse this republic is by destroying the economy. Could you address that?
Well, then they're all Leninists, I guess. Remember Lenin wrote that the best way to destroy a democracy is to debauch its currency. I actually think they're a lot stupider than you do. I think they're just utterly inept. I have some contact with Larry Summers, who I think is a prime example of the peculiar kind of intelligence that is produced by universities like Harvard, or I went to school, which rewards a kind of analytical ability to sustain a system. But Larry Summers, like most of the elite, is utterly incapable of critiquing structures or assumptions. They only know how to sustain a system. That's what they're trained to do. They're systems managers. And that's why they are shoveling tons of money out of the U.S. Treasury into zombie banks, because they don't have the intellectual capacity to think outside the narrow structures by which they have been trained. And having taught at Princeton, I have watched, by the time you get to these institutions, through standardized testing, through all of the winnowing process, other forms of intelligence are just not rewarded. And so many state schools have now been reduced essentially to vocational centers. The withering of the humanities, there's a direct correlation between what happened and the withering of the humanities, which trained people to ask those broad questions of meaning. True intelligence, by definition, is subversive because it challenges the established order. It goes all the way back to Socrates. And I think that we have, like many dying empires, essentially been hijacked by a bunch of idiots.
If we were to be able to do away with the Federal Reserve System, which is a big if, would we not then be able to print our own money and not owe banks money in order to properly function our government? Is that a possibility?
I can't answer that. I don't know. I do think Nader, Ralph, had it right. He said, instead of giving hundreds of billions of dollars to Citibank or AIG, what we should do is take $350 billion, start 10 new national banks, capitalize them with $10 billion each, leverage them at 10 to 1 so that they can go out and actually give people loans, mortgages, and credit. That would be a far better use of taxpayer dollars than turning it over to the criminal class, the speculative class, which, of course, is not lending it and paying themselves huge bonuses and using the money to do what got us into the trouble in the first place, not only beginning to, again, sell toxic assets. I don't know who'd buy them, but they're selling them. And then also the mergers. Buying up other companies and then taking it out on the consumer. It's why deregulation of the airlines industry has turned flying into a nightmare because, these large companies swallow each other up, and then in order to cover the costs, you fly packed like sardines from L.A. to New York with just a bag of peanuts and long delays.
Can you say something, please, about the role of nonviolent civil disobedience in some of the movements that you mentioned earlier? Certainly nonviolence... civil disobedience, and sometimes with violence, seem to have a role. And so I wonder if there's any particular role of nonviolent civil disobedience that's relevant now.
Having covered as many wars as I have, I understand the poison of violence, that when people are pushed, and they can be pushed to such an extent that they use violence to ensure their own survival, a good example being those trapped in the city of Sarajevo during the war in Yugoslavia. I was in Sarajevo for the war. But it doesn't save you from the pernicious effects of violence, which is why the criminal class, the gangsters, organized the defenses of the city. And when they weren't shooting Serbs across the barricades, they were looting the apartments of ethnic Serbs who would remain behind in carrying out executions. So my fear is that the corporate state will remain so intransigent that it will punish us and the rest of the planet to such a degree with a kind of immoral blindness that it will eventually trigger a violent response. And if that happens, there's one side of me that understands it, but on the other side, I fully know that those who fight dragons become dragons. Then we have entered a scenario of incredibly tragic proportions. And that is why I think if there's one novel for our age, it's probably Notes from Underground by Dostoevsky, which is about a bankrupt liberalism. And I think that the danger comes in the end, not from a pernicious right wing, but from a liberalism that has lost its spine. That we talk about caring about the rights of workers, and yet since 1994, we have largely been supporting a Democratic Party that has decimated the working class in this country. And the anger on the part of much of the working class towards liberals is not misplaced because of that hypocrisy. We talk about wanting to end our permanent war economy, half of all discretionary spending going to arms manufacturers, the prosecution of what under post-Nuremberg laws are defined as criminal wars of aggression, and yet we vote for a party that continually funds and supports war. And I think that we have to find the courage of our convictions, and even if that means standing outside of the mainstream, you know, look at the very serious intellectual and moral voices in American society. Ralph Nader, Dennis Kucinich, Jeremiah Wright. What does the mainstream press do? They turn them into figures of ridicule. They turn them into jokes because they can't compete with them in terms of ideas. And we have to begin to understand how controlled we are and what the motives behind those controlling forces are. And that means all the way around, the further we can step away from the mainstream and begin to create an alternative, the faster we can save our country. Because if we don't create that alternative, then we are going to end up with a very terrifying, I fear, Christian/corporate dystopia.
Could you comment on the absence of moral outrage by a significant percentage of the American public? There was moral outrage in the 30s, there was in the 50s, and there wasn't in the 60s, but it seems to me to be remarkably absent over the past 20 years. Why do you think that is true?
I think a lot of it comes from the shift from a literate or a print-based society to an image-based society. That you have 42 million Americans who are illiterate. You have another 50 million Americans who read at about a fourth or fifth grade level. That's about a third of the country. And then you have a large sector of the population that is functionally literate but no longer reads. And you know, all of these images that are disseminated, we are a culture utterly awash in lies, are designed to impart visions of the world and forms of social conformity to make us confuse how we are made to feel with knowledge, to make us confuse propaganda with ideology. And I think the Obama campaign did that very well. I don't own a television because I don't want them to give me the language by which I speak. I watched in places like Yugoslavia how all of the ethnic factions, whether it was the Serbs, the Croats, or even the Muslims in Bosnia, immediately seized the airwaves and pumped out garbage so that even if you felt a kind of disquiet, you were robbed of the words of vocabulary to express it. And we have that here. Even to use the phrase war on terror was to become caged by the manipulators of information. You can't make a war on terror. Terror is a tactic. It's impossible. And having spent a year of my life covering Al-Qaeda for the New York Times and 7 years in the Middle East, I was based in Paris, but in Europe and the Middle East immediately after 9/11, I watched how the tragedy of 9/11 had garnered for us the empathy of the world, including the Muslim world. Muslims were appalled at what had been done in the name of their religion. The chief Sunni religious leader, Sheikh Tantawi at Al-Azhar in Cairo, immediately after the attacks of 9/11 denounced the attacks as a crime against humanity, but then went on to denounce Osama bin Laden as a fraud, somebody who had no theological legitimacy or training, and therefore no right to issue religious edicts or fatwas. You fight terrorists by isolating them within their own societies. And if, after 9/11, we had had the courage to be vulnerable, we would be far safer and more secure than we are today. Instead, we began dropping iron fragmentation bombs all over the Middle East, which is just what Al-Qaeda wanted. And the tragedy is that, and it was certainly pumped out by the media, including my own paper at the time, the New York Times, this sick nationalist cant. I remember I was in Times Square when the planes hit, and that later that night, my son, who was 10 at the time, asked me, what's the difference between the Americans who wave the really big flags out their car window and the ones who wave the small flags? And I said, well, the ones who wave the really big flags are the really big assholes. The flip side of nationalism. Nationalism is a form of self-exaltation, and the flip side of nationalism is always racism. So that I would fly back from Paris, walk into the newsroom of the Times, even at the Times, and hear jokes about the French, about French identity, French culture, French history. French are our allies. The French share our values. The French attempted to tell us what was true, that Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction. He was not trying to reconstitute a nuclear weapons program. He had no links with Al-Qaeda. But we, as a culture, as a country, drank that very dark elixir of nationalism and violence and decided that we were going to communicate to the rest of the world in the language of violence. And that is how we have ended up to where we are today.
You had mentioned about how we're in a highly technological surveillance state. And I've done a lot of reading about the New Left and how it got co-opted by COINTELPRO programs of the FBI. And you had recommended that folks further the Green Party or the Socialist Party. And I am concerned that those can be easily co-opted. And how do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, that's the risk we have to take. I know Ralph Nader very well. I guarantee you he isn't going to get co-opted.
The people who are behind the leaders are the ones that dictate what the leaders are going to do when you're in a grassroots movement. So if the ideas of the people are manipulated by COINTELPRO activities, then the leaders...
Well, I don't think that that's a good definition of politicians. It's not a definition of leaders. You know, I covered, for instance, Yitzhak Rabin in Israel. And when Rabin announced that he was going to begin a peace process with the Palestinians, he was a very lonely figure in Israeli society. He had a vision. He exhibited the qualities of leadership. He expressed that vision to a public. And then he reached out and pulled Israeli society with him. That is leadership. Rabin had it. And after his assassination, no subsequent Israeli leader has had the quality of leadership or the vision to create a process that I think would not only be fair and just to the Palestinians, but ultimately lie within Israel's interest as well. I'm just going to close with a little poem by Langston Hughes. It's called Let America Be America Again. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain seeking a home where he is free. America never was America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great, strong land of love, where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme that any man be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery's scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old, stupid plan of dog-eat-dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient, endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker, sold to the machine. I am the Negro, servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean. Hungry yet today, despite the dream. Beaten yet today, O pioneers. I am the man who never got ahead, the poorest worker battered through the years. Yet I'm the one who dreamt our basic dream in the old world while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone, in every furrow turned that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I'm the one who left dark Ireland's shore and Poland's plain and England's grassy lea, and torn from black Africa's strand, I came to build a homeland of the free. The free? Who said the free? Not me, surely not me. The millions on relief today, the millions shot down when we strike, the millions who have nothing for our pay. For all the dreams we've dreamed and all the songs we've sung and all the hopes we've held and all the flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for our pay except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose, the steel of freedom does not stain. For those who live like leeches on other people's lives, we must take back our land again, America. Oh, yes, I say it plain, America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain, all. all the stretch of these great green states and make America again. Thank you.